Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Today is episode 2 of just a two-part series that Pete wanted to do, political series called Trump, May, Putin and Men in Funny Hats. So he's going to give you a quick recap of what he did in the last episode and then give you a summary of what he wants to discuss today. Today is Monday the 23rd of July, so we're trying to do a bit of a current affairs type thing, but obviously it's quite fast paced, so we're trying to keep up with it as best we can. So let's start off just by reminding our listeners what it was that you did in the last episode.
What I did in part one, which I recorded a couple of days ago, is a comment on the experience of immersing myself in news and commentary and events of the previous week. Now, in the previous week, Donald Trump launched a charm offensive and travelled east.
I love that expression, charm offensive.
And he had a summit with NATO in Brussels, followed by a summit with Theresa May, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, in the UK, at Chequers and Blenheim Palace and various places, and followed up on Monday a week ago, yet today, with a conference with a summit with Vladimir Putin, the president of the Russian Federation, and a subsequent press conference. And I watched the Putin Trump press conference. I watched the May Trump press conference in their entirety. Listened to a fair bit of the commentary from every kind of angle, left and right, I have to say. And at the same time, this was happening in the context of having watched a long series on Netflix documenting the history of the Vietnam War, which pretty well went on from 1945 well up into the 1970s. An absolutely pivotal global catastrophe, I have to say. And there is a series, and I recommend that if you've got Netflix that you try and watch it. It's grueling, it's soul-wrenching. And it really emphasises this scoundrel bastardy of the political class. And you can hear this in President Johnson's private phone conversations, which were recorded, and President Nixon's private phone conversations, and briefings with military and so forth, which is also recorded. And it does seem, in as much as possible, that this is a fairly balanced account. But I don't know, is it 10 episodes, something like that? And they're well over an hour, they're 80 minutes, it's a lot of...
Pretty intensive, then.
There's a lot of material. But it's essential knowledge for anybody who's vaguely interested in raising the game of their punditry. And, of course, in modern times, everybody's a pundit. Absolutely everybody's a pundit. So, you know, and fair enough. Probably on balance and in time will prove to be a good thing, maybe. But yeah, if you can raise your punditry, watch that. That's my advice. So that's where I'm at, and I kind of watched some other things. There was Al Gore's revisitation of global warming. And brief summaries of all this material you can hear on the previous podcast. So what I did in that first one was, as I say, try to work up to some extent the proposition and to assert the proposition that the political class are generally fucking bastards and scoundrels and psychopaths. And I did signal the intention this one to talk about fragmentation, because once again what I'm seeing, having immersed myself intensely in the clamour and the discourse and the meme wars and the circus and the pompous pomposity of ceremony, state ceremony, is that this aperçu that I keep mentioning really is the case, that the world is fragmenting culturally, economically, materially. The fragmentation is the key in which world history is unfolding. Now, it's all very well saying that, and it does sound like it's astrology or something, you know, it's like Pluto's moving into the ninth, I don't know, you know, and it's, because it's that kind of statement, but it is simply an observation. And it's admittedly an observation made by a bloke who stays in his room surfing the net some other time, doing a little bit of bureaucratic jobs for people, studying and going for walks. Well, I don't go very far from the door, really. So what the fuck do I know? I don't whiz round the world with the press corps or whatever. So it's that as well. But what I want to unpick is the way in which this fragmentary unfolding, which I think is undoubted, I don't think there's any controversy about that, is grounded in the materiality of the economy, but also the materiality of the cultures that contain the various economies, or which in which the world economy is embedded as well. They too are material forces. I'm not going to get too dualist about superstructure and base here, but I want to get into something that's kind of concrete, that makes it sound a little less flaky to assert that the world is fragmenting, and it's got nothing to do with the Book of Revelations. Right?
Yeah. So can you, in a general way, just say what you feel that the forces of fragmentation are?
I can try. Firstly, I think we have to take account of environmental degradation. And I do recommend that you watch Al Gore's film called An Inconvenient Truth, which is about man-made climate change, and Al Gore's recent update called An Inconvenient Sequel, which was made last year. And Al Gore hasn't rested between 2006, when the first film was made, and 2017, when the second film was made. He's a tireless campaigner and diplomat in the various forums, like the Paris Accord, which was agreed last year, and which Donald Trump trashed by one of his first acts as president was to bring America out of the accord. And this is a huge player that we're not, it's not so, it's not mentioned. You know, the anti-climate lobby, in other words, the ideologues of big oil and big coal and the fossil fuel industry, like the Koch brothers, who are throwing immense amounts of money to silence any mention of climate change in the context of the various problems the world is facing, succeeded. You don't hear about it. But let me mention that between 2004 and 2010, in the Middle East, in Syria particularly, there was a drought that went on for 6 years, and that many, many farmers were unable to grow anything. Went bankrupt, 60% Syrian farms.
God,
became unproductive.
That's just shocking.
Yeah, and you wonder why there was unrest.
Yeah.
Now, there's a guy, Christian Peretti, I think that's the guy's name, traced out the the origins of the Tahrir Square demonstrations, which started the Arab Spring in Egypt. And he claims that they started out basically as protests about bread, you know, bread riots, basically. Not exactly riots, but, you know, the price of bread, the staple, rose astronomically because of drought, because of climate change, and consequent harvest failures. So we need to be looking at that. That is definitely producing fragmentary forces. And of course, a consequence of the Arab Spring is that we ended up with a huge proxy war in Syria, the complete destabilising of Libya, and mass movements of populations, refugees. Because what do? When that stuff starts kicking off, everybody would do it. You go somewhere else, you know, because you want to stay alive.
Yeah.
And you don't want to be blown to pieces, and you don't want to starve. You go somewhere else. But of course, this has knock-on effects, and the whole lurch of Europe to the right, which culturally and politically has polarised Europe, with lurches to the right in Poland and Hungary and Italy, and France having a narrow escape, and Brexit is again a consequence of a lurch to the right. I mean, basically Cameron called the referendum in the hope that he would be able to marginalise UKIP and Nigel Farage. They're pretty right-wing. They might claim that they're kind of decent folk, but they're kind of flag wavers. I was going to be polite, you know. So you can see, you get this knock-on effect, and it might be that, if not the primary cause, which it may be the primary cause, but if not the primary cause, he's certainly a big player in this game, climate change. Mm. But of course, Trump, at the time that the Paris Agreement was being struck to get the world onto a non-fossil fuel energy economy as quickly as possible, was saying that it was 100% a waste of time, his exact words. Yeah. Of course, his mates, the oil barons and the coal barons, and this was superficially attractive to in the Rust Belt and in the mining areas of the US, where there was unemployment, you know, working class people, which they could blame quite easily on the global demand to move from fossil fuel to solar and wind and so forth, and hydro, and tidal, in other words, renewable energy. So it was a win-win for Trump to play into that, in terms of Rust Belt votes and Coal Belt votes. And in terms of doing a favour to his mates, the other fucking billionaires, the Koch brothers and all the rest of it. But it's pretty disgusting. I mean, and also, when Trump got in, one of his first move was basically to start dismantling the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. And he sticks a big oil waller, or a big coal waller, in charge of that. He sacked that bloke, actually, recently, because of some funny money stuff, some dodgy dealings with the money. And but he's the new appointee, he's from Big Coal. So you can see on that political level that very thing of environmental degradation has had this political twist in the fallout. The Paris Agreement, which I think was finally signed, I think it was in April 2017, you know, was hard won, because India and the Third World in general stuck out, and they had got quite a good argument. As long as solar was a bit more expensive than coal, India was going to build 10 more coal-fired power stations, huge ones, and refused to cancel that on the grounds that, well, you guys had 150 years of putting this shit into the atmosphere, and that's why you've got the standard of living that you got.
It's our turn now.
And it's our turn now, yeah. You know. So, I mean, Al Gore actually did a lot of moves to get tariffs taken off solar panels and so forth, so that they were competitive. And then India finally signed, because they, by digging their heels in there, you know, they got some help with it. I don't think it's fair enough, but it was tricky. It was touch and go. This, and Trump, of course, just trashed it, you know. So there's that's the number one element, you know, is environmental degradation. It produces fragmentation in a number of ways. You get political movements caused by the economic consequences, i.e. bread riots, yeah?
Yeah.
You know, political and social instability because of farms failing and that kind of thing. And then you get like political manoeuvring within that universe of discourse, producing things like Trump getting elected, you know, and the polarisation, the cultural polarisation over this whole matter, worldwide, but particularly in America. And all this flowing out of that one thing, that, you know, there's the material cause of the fragmentation, the cultural fragmentation that reaches the point of huge cataclysmic proxy wars. And the Syria wars killed 1 million people or something. And then, of course, the movements of populations and how that causes problems and how it allows people to play the xenophobia card. I mean, I'm extremely cosmopolitan, but I do know that people get upset if millions and millions of people who speak different languages and with different customs just suddenly flood into your neighbourhood, you know. It disturbs people. You know, however charitable you want to be about this and non-xenophobic, it disturbs people. You know, but what is the cause? The cause is people having no security at home. I suppose that number two is related to number one, and they kind of flow out of each other to some extent. Even though a fundamentalist Marxist might want to say that number one flows out of number two. Number two is the economic system. And the economic system is a trickle up. We know this, we saw this in 2008. The consequences of which we're still living with, in which the banks brought the world to its knees economically, the biggest crash since 1929, probably bigger than 1929, and they made a profit out of it. They shorted it, they sold dodgy products, and they've been allowed to by the deregulation of finance capital. Pretty well started by Thatcher, but then, you know, Gordon Brown and the Big Bank, Glass-Steagall, Dodd-Frank, blah, blah. We know that they were pretty well allowed to behave fast and loose with the economy, with the inevitable result. But no banker was prosecuted. And no banker was prosecuted because the corporations, the banking corporations, the military corporations, the military-industrial corporations, the big pharma corporations, the big chemical corporations, they're all actually in bed with each other. We have a completely fascistic entanglement of state power and corporate power. So, the trickle-up economic system. They keep telling us that it's a trickle-down system and things have never been better, and that you've got higher employment than ever. They're saying this in the UK, they're saying it in America. Actually, you look close. If you work for 1 hour a week, counts as employed. If you're so demoralised that you just don't bother to seek work and you don't sign on and you sit in a cardboard box and beg, you're not counted in the statistics. You're not economically active. It's only the economically active which are counted in the statistics. And this is the way in which you need to dig beneath the statistics to see that the rosy picture that they're painting is a falsification. GDP has in fact gone up, gross domestic product, but wages have remained stagnant for years. So where's this extra money going? Well, it's going to the 1%, you know. And then Trump comes along and gives him some tax cuts. Yeah, so what you've got
is generous of him.
Yeah. So what you've got is gross inequalities of wealth and power. And you've also got a population that's realising that there are gross inequalities of wealth and power. Now, the way they're analysing that is it's going in all kinds of directions. They're saying it's immigrants, you know. Some of them are realising that the banksters have got a guilty in a certain respect. And so you're getting all kinds of all kinds of readings of that situation. Some people think that the fragmentation is caused by the fact that nations are cosmopolitan and ethnically diverse and culturally diverse. Multiculturalism. Some people blame multiculturalism. You know. And it would be, we'd have a wonderful utopia if we got like a white ethno state and perhaps maybe a black ethno state, you know, and some kind of barbed wire separating the two. Yeah, and there's people actually seriously contemplate these kind of ideas. But the result is a cultural fragmentation brought about by people realising the primary fact that there are gross inequalities of wealth and power. It makes people feel powerless. This is eventually why they do take to the streets. Yeah. It's what happened in Egypt. It's what happened in Tunisia, it's what happened in Syria. It's why 250,000 people had a huge party in London and a social gathering to protest Trump coming to the UK just last week, last weekend. Now, another aspect of these gross inequalities of wealth and power is the entanglement that I just mentioned of corporate power and state power. And what we've had is a revolving door of personnel is one feature of this. It's easier to illustrate this in the case of the US than it is in the case of the United Kingdom. Now it's the same here, and investigate the British state's role in supplying arms to Saudi Arabia, and you'll just Google around a little bit and you'll see what I mean. It's not like the UK is exempt from this, but it's a bit more in your face in the US. And I'm indebted to Lee Camp for this information, but it is good information in the public domain.
Okay. He's a YouTuber.
Yeah,
so if you
he's a comedian.
To check him out, by the way, he's very funny as well, isn't he?
Yeah, this was the 21st of July he was telling us this stuff. But I mean, I've been researching this, you know, in papers and such like, and the case of the UK. It's demonstrable, without too much trouble, that corporation power, corporate power and state power are all kind of tangled up together. And that's Mussolini's definition of fascism, basically. You know, but of course, this it's all for the benefit of the chief players in the corporations and in the government, who become very, very rich as a result, and also accrue enormous power as a result. And it's this, and it was then producing a massive inequality of wealth and power, which people at the bottom of society, inverted commas, are discerning. Okay, the way they analyse that, as I said, it's very varied. It can produce right-wing analyses and left-wing analyses. You know, and that in turn produces fragmentation and running fights on the streets, just as you saw in Munich in the 1930s. And we've had some kind of hints at that, you know. Anyway, the good case is the case of the Obama administration. I mean, Obama it gets painted as the golden boy, and he certainly had lovely manners. And the fact that he was a black man is great. But actually, he was, you know, he dropped as many bombs as Bush or more. And he did some good things. But that same scoundrel bastardy psychopathy was there in the Obama administration as much as in any other. And the chief feature of that which we should take issue with as people, as citizens, as feeling human beings, is that states, particularly the US state, but states all around the world, treat the lives of ordinary people as dispensable. There's nothing more than figures on a spreadsheet. And they'll do the ceremonies and salute the fucking cenotaph, but it's hypocrisy. Because you hear them talking behind closed doors and they say, send 50,000 more troops, and they know that 10,000 will get injured or... Yeah. They know. Mm-hmm. They get told, the generals tell them, and they say, yes, do it. And until there's an absolutely overwhelming push for peace as the prime mover of politics, we're fucked. We're fucked. I mean, in order to have peace, of course, you have to have security. You know, you have to have security for local communities so you don't get huge catastrophic movements of refugees. And that in turn means looking after the climate, looking after the ecosphere, which, at the end of the day, is the very root of life at all. No ecosphere, no life.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jay Johnson was Obama's Department of Homeland Security boss, or one of them. On leaving office, he went straight to Lockheed Martin. Lockheed Martin is the biggest arms manufacturer in the world and has, of course, got enormous clout. Yeah. You wonder why they have these wars and they say, which for justice and da-da-da. It's, these guys make a lot of money. And President Trump, first thing he did when he got into office was up the military budget. But a huge amount, 7% or something.
Whoa.
It's nearly a $2 trillion budget. Worldwide, it is $2 trillion. That's a lot of dosh.
Yeah.
Anyway, I've got a load of these. I won't read you all of them. Eric Holder, who was Obama's attorney general, he's his top lawyer, government lawyer. He didn't prosecute the banks. There were calls for the banks to be prosecuted. Nobody went to jail. Goldman Sachs made billions. They knew what they were doing. They knew they were selling this shit. These shit derivatives. What were they called? Collateralized debt obligations, and they were reclaiming. They were reclaiming the houses because of the default on the mortgages, and then renting them back to people at very high rents. So they'd had the initial payments. They got the money for selling the house, and then they got the rent off and then they shorted the whole thing because they knew it was going to happen. Which is, like, they bet that there was going to be a crash and won. And nobody went to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody, you know, one bank was allowed to fail, as the Lehman Brothers was allowed to fail, but we had too big to fail. Gordon Brown, same thing happened here, of course, Northern Rock. Pretty well every bank got bailed out, and we were with the Co-op Bank, and we thought, well, they didn't get bailed out, but they still got into trouble, because it was a cooperative bank, you know. The Co-op Bank is now owned by a hedge fund. But pretty well everything, Lloyds, Barclays didn't get into trouble, everybody else got into trouble. And Gordon Brown, at one point, and when he said too big to fail, bail them out, they bailed them out, the British taxpayer bailed them out. You know, because people were going to lose their savings. So, what do you do? You know, so... at one point, in 2000 and... back end of 2008, or 2009, I think it might have been. No, I think it was the back end of 2008. Gordon Brown said, in the public domain, we're considering the second bailout. Is the first one enough? Of course, what they did is printed loads of money and give it to them. You know, Mickey Mouse money. But now it's interesting that the Genesis block of the Bitcoin blockchain... Remember that the Bitcoin white paper was written in 2008. And then the blockchain was implemented in 2009, early. It might have been February or something. And Satoshi Nakamoto encoded the front page of the Times of London. And the headlines on the front page of the Times on that particular day said, Gordon Brown, or Chancellor, considering second bank bailout. And that is encoded forever in the Genesis block of the Bitcoin blockchain. If you want to know what Bitcoin's about, why did Satoshi do that? Because, fuck me, this is untenable, you know. And you want to know about, you want to know about revolving doors. Anyway, Eric Holder, who's Obama's Attorney General, he didn't prosecute the banks. There was a call for him to prosecute the banks, but he didn't. He took the decision, we won't prosecute the banks. When he left office, he went into a big law partnership. And the primary brief of this law partnership is to defend banks. Don't you love it? I mean, just while we're on finance, I think Mary Shapiro was Obama's SEC person. The SEC is the Securities and Exchange Commission, and they kind of oversee and regulate securities. Make sure people are not being cheated by dodgy people selling dodgy investments. And anyway, when she left office, she went straight to Morgan Stanley, one of these big monstrous banks that fucked everything up in the, you know. I thought one more. Obama's chief health advisor was Tom Vislach, and he left office and he became a lobbyist for Taco Bell, those well-known purveyors of health foods. Anyway, one more example, because I love this shit, to be honest.
You just couldn't make it up, really.
You couldn't make it up, yeah. Obama himself got paid $400,000 for a single speech on leaving office. 1 hour.
That is a good rate of pay.
And where did he deliver the speech? In Wall Street, for the Wall Street operatives. So, draw your own conclusions, you know. So, I'm saying that, you know, this factor is the nature of the economy, the trickle-up nature of the economy, which, as you should be able to see from this, is incredibly unstable. Leading on to the third thing, which is the entanglement of corporate and state power into a single entity. Fascism. So, all this is jumping out at me from this thing. So I'll just recap there. We've got environmental degradation has been a factor in fragmentation, leading to cultural fragmentation, for reasons I think I've explained. Inequality, gross inequalities of wealth and power, which in turn are related to the monetary system and the monetary instability. I mean, just printing money, you know. The financial system don't work. It's an intrinsically unstable system, and it's coming. It just, they managed to keep kind of like rescuing it and tweaking it and stuff, but it's fucked. Whichever way you look at it, it's fucked. And again, that leads to cultural instability. There's the tech. I have to say, there's the tech as well. And technological innovations can be incredibly disruptive of societies, and again, leading to cultural and social.
Disruptive in a good way.
Well, it can be painful to be on the receiving end of it. You know, solar has put coal miners out of work, and they don't like it.
An ultimately, you know, good way.
Yeah, yeah. But the tech, I mean, the
bumps in the road, obviously.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on in the tech, and the mind-bending innovations, and loads of them, and that. AI and robotics—it's already taken its toll, and it's progressing apace. But there's a real contradiction at the core of this development, a contradiction of capital. Capitalism relies on competition, and the claim is that innovation is stimulated by competition. So you've got three firms, A, B and C, all making widgets. Firm A has got a bit of a whiz kid engineer in the back room, and he modifies one of the machines, and suddenly one worker can make twice as many widgets. So He protects his invention with a patent or keeps it secret. But firms B and C have got to do something similar, so they develop their own, just to get an advantage. Otherwise, they could become bankrupt, you know, because firm A, maybe the product's even better, and he can sell it cheaper, because he only needs one worker instead of two workers. Yeah.
Yeah.
So competition is a race. It's an arms race. Of it, it's at the core of capitalism. You know, capitalist states, the one thing that they do, however much they claim they believe in the minimal state, the one thing that they do is prevent monopolies. In the UK, it's the CMA, which is the Markets Authority. And they've got power, they've got legal power, they can fine people, they can prosecute people. Because the one thing they can't have is monopoly. Now the claim is that this produces innovation, and you can see that it does produce innovation. Even though you have to bear in mind that big government also produces innovations that firms can't, however rich they are. The example is the iPhone. Everything in your iPhone was developed either in the universities or by the military. The innovative thing that Apple did was put them together. They didn't invent any of them. They were innovations that were only made possible by big government, big military, big universities, big corporate universities. So it's a bit of a misnomer, but nevertheless, the fact is that capitalism needs this competition. And this is why we've got automation, because automation allows productivity. Huge productivity per worker. And in fact, eventually human workers could be eliminated entirely. And of course, you don't have to pay robots. You have to buy them, but you don't have to pay them. And then they'll work 24 hours a day. Somebody made a strawberry picking robot because they're kind of a bit worried that Brexit will prevent all the Poles and Eastern Romanians to come and pick the strawberries. The locals don't want to do it. They've all got jobs writing C programs, you know. In a tech park somewhere, you know,
yeah.
Or flipping burgers, and at least it's indoors, you know, or I don't know, working as porn stars or something. I don't know.
Yoga teachers.
Yeah, but the world is that they don't want to pick strawberries. So somebody invented a strawberry picking robot, and it's only half the speed of a human picker, because it's a very difficult task for a robot to pick a strawberry because of how soft it is. They're good at firm pressure, but, you know,
yeah.
It's a bit more of a technical challenge to get a light pressure. So the thing's quite slow, but of course it works 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
You know, non-stop, it'll just keep going and going, Saturday, Sunday, you know. So the slowness is not really a disadvantage. But the thing is, enterprises A, B and C are more or less forced in an arms race to go for automation, yeah?
Mm.
To improve their tech in such a way that it improves their productivity.
And historically, like right back to, I don't know, the Stone Age, that was just the same, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It was ever thus, you know, it's built into technical production, which is stuff that human beings have to do if we want to wear clothes, live in houses, eat safe food, entertain ourselves. We've got to do this shit, you know. So, but the thing is, the clincher here is that the workers earn money and they spend it on staying alive, on educating their kids, on entertaining themselves. They spend it. And he's spending it to create demand for the products that they themselves are making. Because there's no demand, your productivity can be as high as you fucking like. If there's no demand, you go bust.
Yep.
You're not going to just produce stuff to pile it up. You go bust, you know. But you're actually like sacking workers, sacking workers. So at some point you're going to have to give them some money or in some method some access to the goods that are being produced by the automated economy. And this is the contradiction. And again, it's producing fragmentation. And you can see a cultural clash between people with high-skilled jobs who are not likely to be laid off that quickly, and people whose labour is easily automated. We already see it, you know, because these produce different cultures. And people, of course, live in their bubbles. Despite the internet, people live in their bubbles. And the cultures diverge. So that's one of the impacts of the tech. I mean, one of the other impacts of the tech is, of course, like how these disparate cultural forms, in other words, these narratives and explanations of the fragmentation, of the resentment, which ultimately stems out of the gross inequalities of wealth and power, and able to be distributed by the social media and by the internet. It's an incredibly fast rate. You know, half the world is now on the internet. You know. And then there's so much bloody stuff, so much material. And what I'm doing now is the result of just immersing myself in some of that, like a fragment of it. This is what it's doing to my brain.
Yeah.
You know? So there's that as well, the tech. So we've got environmental degradation. We've got cultural schisms as a result of that. We've got the logic of capital, in other words, the need for consumers as well as producers, and consumers with money to buy the products being produced, and the impact of automation and tech on that. The impact of information technology on culture, resulting in culture wars. I should mention, again, in the capitalist vein, you know, the anti-capitalist vein, the struggle for resources. There's a lot of people on the planet, and oil, we might well have passed peak oil. Oil's running out. Yeah. And I've mentioned that as a byproduct of all that, the huge movement to population and the cultural and political problems that causes, whether we like it or not. And as another part of that, I mentioned the entanglement of the corporations, the huge corporations, with governments and the implications of that. So I think that there's, I don't know, what half a dozen or so, what I would say are material forces which together are producing the fragmentation that we're experiencing. This is why Scotland wants to leave the UK, or tried to and just narrowly pipped it, didn't quite. Why the UK wants to leave the EU. Why
well, half of the UK wants to leave the EU. Yeah. The other half really didn't, us included.
Yeah. But the fact that there is that fragmentation is possible.
Yeah.
You know, and and why Italy, you know, the talk is Italy is, we've got Brexit, we've got Italy, and, you know, they've had a lurch to the right. You'd think they'd know better, having been the country that invented fascism. Yeah. Hungary, Poland, you know, Russia. I mean, it does look different from other places in the world, but there's the other great blocs, China, India, Russia, and then the West, you might call, and then the Third World, Africa, and some parts of Latin America. They're all entangled together, they're all enmeshed together. You get a local picture of exactly the same general unfoldings in China. You can explain the Chinese situation in exactly this way.
Just looking at your notes here, and you've put, there are some decent folks in politics.
Yes, well, I mentioned, I was impressed by Al Gore when I saw his film. I dare say he's got some skeletons in the cupboard. I mean, he was Clinton's right-hand man. who knows what kind of parties they went to. But just a bloke who has tirelessly worked to save the environment, tirelessly, and a consummate politician, and he seems to me a decent chap. I might be wrong, you see, because, you know, we're dealing with people's presentations of themselves. I think Jeremy Corbyn's all right. I think a Labour government will be just as messy as any kind of government in this country. But anything to piss off Nigel Farage, you know. I'd have Mickey Mouse as Prime Minister if it pissed him off. So that's roughly where I'm at with fragmentation as a result of watching the men in the funny hats march up and down. And I didn't mention, actually, about the Trump Theresa May press conference. And all, you know, you could watch Trump landing in his helicopter and the Grenadier Guards in their big bearskin hats and their red coats. The irony, the red coats. Marching up and down for him and playing the band's playing the anthems. And the sycophantic, arse-licking fucking commentator on the BBC or Channel 4 News or whatever saying, you know, in hushed tones, the magnificence of the band's playing and this special relationship and blah, 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 blah. And you think, what bollocks, what fucking infantile bollocks, yeah. To be honest with you. And of course, Trump's in a bubble. And there's one pundit says he don't give a shit about the 250,000 marching up and down in Trafalgar Square. And do they think he's going to take any notice and they could stop him? Of course they don't. They know they can't stop him. That's not what is happening there. They're having a party and they're networking and they're having a dress rehearsal to see how they can manage crowds on the streets. And they're sending a message to like-minded people across the Atlantic to say, look, you're not on your own. This is what's happening. It's nothing to do with trying to stop him. They know they can't stop him. So, but Trump doesn't see that. He lands in his helicopter, comes in out of Air Force One, into the helicopter that they bring everywhere with him, flies to the fucking Blenheim Palace. It's totally unreal. It's a palace the size of a fucking small country, where Winston Churchill was born, you know. So all symbolism, this symbolic game they play, it's how fucking infantile. But the thing about it, that you've always got soldiers marching up and down, you know. And they actually said that at the press conference that they'd been to Sandhurst to watch the special forces, US Navy SEALs and SAS, strutting their stuff, doing unarmed combat and stuff like that, as a display put on by the British government for Trump. Where did they take him? To a military academy, you know, to show like the military cooperation. To do something impressive, and then he's surrounded with troops marching up and down.
That didn't take him to the Eden Project.
No, it's just militarism. And militarism is right at the core of this bubble that these despicable psychopaths who dispose of people's lives like numbers on a spreadsheet live in. Militarism is a part and parcel of it. And of course, remember that the military industrial complex, Lockheed Martin, Halliburton, Raytheon, Boeing, BEA, you know, these huge companies have got like a stranglehold on the government. It's the same people, as I've just illustrated to you. And then on the symbolic level, the role played by militarism. And it's so remote from people. People like me who walk up and down the canal living on a pension. Or the guys in come and cut the grass. Or the chaps driving the trains and so on. All this is so kind of remote from them. You wonder why there's fragmentation. But because in the information age, you're getting an inkling that there is a gross inequality of wealth and power. That there are these big and very dark and nefarious forces calling the tune on planet Earth. You get a hint of it. But at the same time, you know, the minute those powers realise the people are onto them, they throw up a smoke screen. And so you've got trolls and bots and in fact the whole kind of free speech of the internet, which I suppose in the last analysis is a good thing. Well, in the first analysis is a good thing. Nevertheless, gives the opportunity for obscuration and ideology as well. So it's a two-ended stick. The information's out there, and it's very hard to find it. And of course, then you get, you know, the cultural disparity, the cultural fragmentation is nowhere more evident than in social media and on the internet and in internet publications. All intensified by the speed at which information bounces around the world.
Yeah. And just speaking of information, I think that in my experience of using the internet to try and learn things or any source actually, it's always good to try and get your information about anything you're looking into from at least more than one source.
Yeah. Look at stuff that you don't like and it makes you feel uncomfortable, but check, you know, and try and make an appraisal of reliability.
Yeah.
And always have a pinch of salt.
It's very easy to kind of like fall for like some confident presenter.
Yeah.
Who's talking like, and they really sound like they know what they're talking about. Yeah. But if you actually have any, I found anyway, if I actually have like a good depth of knowledge about that particular thing,
yeah,
I'm thinking, wow, they sound so convincing, yeah, but they are actually completely wrong.
Bear this in mind, and I think I'm going to leave you with this, is that because somebody sounds plausible, doesn't mean to say that what they're saying is true,
no,
sensible, cogent, well-reasoned. Remember, sophists abound. Yeah. Most of our politicians are sophists. And most of our journalists are sophists. These are people who have the appearance of philosophical acumen, whilst not really having it.
Yeah.
Not really being prepared to dig deep into anything. If anybody lies the spider side too soon, it's them. And they're everywhere.
Yeah.
Beware of it. Have some scepticism. And remember to take a walk somewhere quiet where you can observe the fish and the ducks and the trees.
For the sake of your information, and turn it over in your mind.
Yeah, for the sake of your sanity, have a bit of quiet. Okay, I want to stop now.
Okay,
well, I could go on, but
well, we're nearly at town now, anyway.
Yeah.
So I hope everybody found that interesting. There's quite a lot of stuff in there for you all to have a good think about. Some of it quite shocking, I'm sure. If you want to be really shocked, watch the as Pete was suggesting, there's series on Netflix, the one about Trump,
yes,
and the one about the Vietnam War.
Oh, and watch Al Gore's
Thing as well, yeah.
An Inconvenient Sequel.
Yeah.
The Vietnam thing, yeah. I mean, I'd put those sort of fairly equal, I'd watch them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Something if you just like turn over in your mind. All right, well, I hope that was interesting for you all, and we will speak to you again soon.
Thanks for listening.